How about let's pray?
Okay. That sounds like a good idea. You want me to pray?
Yes.
Heavenly Father.
Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Friend, beloved God. Great Masters.
Great Masters.
Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ.
Babaji Krishna. Lahiri Mahashaya. Swami Sri Yukteswar. And our beloved Guru, Paramahansa Yoganandaji. Friend and guide, Swami Kriyananda, saints of all religions, we ask for your presence here with us today. Speak through our hearts and through our minds, that we may show everyone everywhere your grace and your glory. Om, peace, amen.
I will ask you about Ananda, but I want to know about your delightful upbringing and where it all was and what your family was like and what you remember about that.
You want a quick life story here, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, and I usually start out with that because you'll hear the South in my voice. It never has been able to be erased, but, you know, maybe it's part of my personality. I hope so anyway, because there's not a lot I can do about it. But anyway, I lived there until I was 18, and then I was an only child. My parents were very kind people. They were Southern Baptists, so I had that kind of a very almost rigid religious upbringing, full of difficult things for me to overcome in later years. But the church was our life, so most of my social life, rather than being involved in my school, it was more at my church because we were there morning, noon, and night, many days of the week. And so I felt, you know, that was my, that was the core of the way I was brought up as a child. So at age 18, my parents told me I could go to any college and university in the United States as long as it was Baptist. So that limited my choices a bit, but I did pick out Baylor University in Waco, Texas, primarily because it was 600 miles away from home, and I figured no matter what's going on, I'm far enough away that I can start to really live my own life more. So I went to college, and I majored in English literature, which is a pretty worthless degree. So when I got out of college, I decided I wanted to travel. So I went to work for an airline. I was based in Houston. I was still in Texas. I liked Texas. I enjoyed it while I was there. So when I got out of college, I just stayed and went to Houston and worked, lived there and worked there and flew all over the world, had a great time. So after about 8 years of that, I got a little tired of travel, as one does if you just travel all the time. And so I decided that it was time for me to drop out. So what I mean by that is I quit my job and I moved into a hippie commune. That was a rather radical change in my life, but it was a beautiful place out in the country between Houston and Austin. It was called the Peaceable Kingdom. And we raised animals and we had organic gardens way before they were, you know, happening. And I learned how to make quilts, and we gave classes, and we had a fine time. It was just a small community, not at all like Ananda, more of a kind of party central artsy craftsy place. But it was fun, and I learned a lot, and I lived there for about 6 years. And during that time, I took the time to start doing my exploration of spiritual matters. And I read the autobiography of a yogi, and I was doing my best to meditate on my own, which was not easy because I really didn't know how, but I was trying. And somewhere after the time I read the autobiography, and maybe a few years later, somebody came to me and said, "Did you know that there's a community out in California where everybody who lives there is a follower of Yogananda? I know you're a follower of Yogananda." I said, "No, I certainly did not know that." And they said, "Well, yeah, you should find out about it." Well, these were the days before internets and emails. And it took me a while to find Ananda. I mean, I knew Self-Realization Fellowship in Southern California, but I had somehow understood that Ananda was in Northern California. So it took me some while to find it, but I found it, and I wrote a letter. That's what you did back in those days, and asked for more information. Well, I got a very, very sweet letter back from Kalyani, who lived here at that time, and inviting me to come to Ananda. And I thought that was so sweet. Here's this stranger, you know, and she's inviting me to come. So she also sent me a little brochure, and I noticed they had what they called the apprentice program coming up the next summer. And the price was definitely right for my budget, because after I quit working for the airline and started living out in the country, I didn't have much money anymore. But believe it or not, back in those years, it was $55 a month to stay here, and a place to pitch your tent, and three meals a day. And for that, you worked in the garden. I worked in the garden, but many people worked in different places. And it was, I came the first year they had that program, and Prakash and Shivani were in charge of it, and it was a wonder. I spent all summer here, and it was a wonderful experience for me. But the main thing was just to be among all these people who are disciples of Paramahansa Yogananda, as I was, because up until that moment when I set foot on this property, I'd never met another disciple. It never occurred to me to figure out whether there were any in Texas. I found out later there were, but I don't know how to find them. So it was a real thrill. And then also, I had been here maybe a week and a half or so, and Swami Kriyananda gave a Saturday class up at our meditation, what's the meditation retreat now, and everybody said, oh, you got to go, you got to hear him speak, and he's the founder of Ananda, disciple of Yogananda. Well, I was definitely ready to meet him, because I had already met a lot of people here just in the first, you know, maybe 10 days, and they were wonderful people, people who are still my dear friends from all these 42, three, I don't know, I've lost track now how many years. It's over 40 years now for sure. But so I went to that first class with Swami, all of us sitting on the ground under a tree up in the woods there. And I was just captured, as many people were, by his talk. And I didn't know this then, but Swami has an amazing ability to understand what's going on in people's heads who are listening to him speak. And he would cast around with his eyes, and he would look. And at one point during his talk, he just looked me right in the eyes and answered the question that was in my mind. And this was the question that was in my mind. My question was, who are you, Swami Kriyananda? Who are you, the head of this place? Are you the guru? Or how do you fit in to all of this? That was the, because I had asked some people and never got a really satisfactory answer. I figured, well, I'll just go right to the source. But I didn't say it out loud. But right in the middle of his lecture, and I don't know what he was talking about that Saturday. It was a two-hour talk. He sort of stopped and looked at me, and he said, you know, I'm not the guru here at Ananda. He said, Paramahansa Yogananda is our guru, and we have a line of great masters, and he points over to the altar where their pictures are. He says, but I'm not the guru. He says, however, I have been a direct disciple. I lived with Yogananda for 3.5 years. I studied with him, and to that degree that I have learned to be his disciple, if you wish to be his disciple, then perhaps I can be of help to you. It was such a beautiful answer, and it took all the threat out of it, because in those years, I don't know how many people remember this, but there's a great deal going on about gurus being really nasty people and or whatever. The head of a community would say something like, bow, neophyte, give me all your money, and I'm taking over your mind control. Oh, you know, just stories like that you heard. And not that I believed that, but I did want to get things straightened out in my own mind. So I accepted his answer fully. And really, by that time, I had barely been here 2 weeks. I realized that this is where I wanted to live. So I spent 3 months here, and then I had to go back to Texas because, you know, I had a life there that I had to complete. And it actually took me about 3 years between that first visit here and for me to move here. And during that time, Swami went out on what were called the joy tours. And so he actually visited, he repaid the visit. He visited me in Texas, and I set up, helped to set up talks in Austin and Houston and Dallas. He then went to those three cities on that first joy tour, he was calling it then. And it was actually after he gave a talk in Houston. That was must have been in about March of 1978, I believe. After his talk, I boldly went up to him and asked him for a spiritual name, because I had asked people, "How do you get a spiritual name?" And I really wanted one, because I never really, I didn't vibrate very well with my given name, which was Jane. I mean, Jane's not a bad name, but I never felt like a Jane. And so I went up to him after a talk, and I said, "Swami, could you give me a spiritual name?" And Swami always surprises us. He surprised me so many times over the years. And he just said, "No, I'm not giving spiritual names anymore." I said, "Oh, okay. Well, thank you. Nice to enjoyed your talk." Or anyway, I was making an idiot of myself probably as I was talking to him. And I turned to walk away. And he said, No, wait a minute." And I turned back around. He said, "I know what your name is." And he said, "Your name is Savitri." It was so pretty the way he said it. It came out of his mouth. And he said, "Have you ever heard the name?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, Shivani over there, grab her when we finish talking and get her to tell you the story of this beautiful story from the Mahabharata about Princess Savitri and all her adventures." And he said, "In India, it's a fairly common name, and parents of girl children love to give their daughter the name Savitri because it's the epitome of a woman's loyalty to her husband." And when he said that, my heart just sank, and I'll tell you why, because I was going through a divorce. Loyalty to her husband. Well, I wasn't actually divorced yet. It was sort of more like a separation coming on. But well, I don't know what this means. But as always, he caught my thought, and he said, "But I want you to think about this name as meaning loyalty to God." And I thought, well, I can deal with that. I think, I hope I can live up to it. But so that was the story of how I got my spiritual name. A very, very sweet moment for me, and a real blessing from Swami, as all of us here who have spiritual names know that that's a real moment in life when you, in a way, your life changes for the better, hopefully. So while he was there in Texas, he said to me more than once, "Why don't you just move to Ananda?" I said, "Well, I've got this life here. I've got this husband, the first husband, and various things." He said, "I think your place is at Ananda." So I took him seriously. I felt it too. So within maybe 3 or 4 months from that first joy tour that Swami was in Texas, I did move to Ananda. And by this time, I'd made a number of friends, good friends here, and they were able to help me, because moving to Ananda in those years was, well, where do you live? Because people are living in not much, teepees and bread trucks and, plastic palaces that we called them. It was almost beyond anything that you'd call substandard housing. It was substandard housing. But somehow we worked it out, and I found a job cooking up at the meditation retreat. I was a cook there, and right away they also got me into leading meditations, yoga postures. So it seemed like almost immediately I was thrown into the world of being with people and teaching, even though I was cooking. So I learned to teach people how to energize and have basic meditation skills and things like that. So that seemed to follow me down through the years. That was the pattern that was set for me, and or God set it in front of me, and I did my best. So I've pretty much my entire, I guess you'd call it working career at Ananda, was involved with being with people, teaching. I have in later years been writing books, and I worked for many, many years at the Expanding Light. I was one of the founders of the yoga teacher training and the founder of the meditation teacher training course. And so that was my thing. That's what I did for all those years. And of course, wonderful to be with Swami. I haven't always lived at Ananda Village. We have lived, Sudarshan and my husband and I. By the way, I should mention this. I got here, and one of the first people I met here when I actually moved here in 1978 was my husband, Sudarshan. And you'll maybe get to meet him later. I don't know. We'll see. But anyway, we were both on the staff at the meditation retreat that first summer I was here. And that's how we met, and eventually we got married in 1980. And but we went to a number of other communities to serve in different ways. We were at Ocean Song, and we were in we had a small community in San Diego for a while before the Los Angeles Ananda got started, sort of a precursor to that one. And we were in Palo Alto for a while. Serving with Asha and all the folks there. So we've had a wonderful time not only living at Ananda Village, but living out in what we used to call the colonies. Now we call it just other Ananda communities. I also have had the wonderful opportunity of traveling to a lot of other places, Tucson and Dallas, and I couldn't possibly think of all the places where I've gone to give workshops and seminars and things like that, but a lot of places, smaller than the communities, more like meditation groups and things like that. So it's all combined is combined to keep me out of trouble and off the streets, I suppose you could say. It's been a wonderful life, and right now I am a little bit more on the retired side, although nobody ever really fully retires at Ananda, it is said. But I'm doing my best to be in what we call the fourth ashram, and that means trying to be a little less out there. Of course, the pandemic hit, and that helped. I mean, everybody's not as much being with people, but just meditating more, being quieter, being alone. I'm still in touch with a lot of people, and I'm doing this video, so I'm not as though it's not as though I'm not in contact with a lot of people or trying to serve as I can, but just trying to back off a little bit as I move towards the later years of my life, I guess is the way you would put that. So that's the main story. That might be way more than you wanted to know.
That's a perfect
But I
summary.
can tell other smaller stories or funny stories or whatever you'd like to hear.
Well, since you brought up the small funny stories, there are two that I'd like to hear about. One, actually, I realized that Darshan did an interview with you that I enjoyed very much, and you told the Elvis story, and that was very delightful. Darshan knows a lot about people. I'm not sure how he knows
I
all
don't know
these
how he found that one out
things.
either. He's a good investigator, yeah.
And then the other thing, somebody mentioned that your mom had some advice to you about husbands. Does
My
that
mom had
ring a
advice. Oh,
bell?
yes, okay, yes, I know what you're talking about
Okay,
now.
so those two things we can start with.
Okay, well, some fun stories. It's true that where I lived in Memphis, Tennessee, Elvis Presley, who was just becoming locally famous in the years I'm talking about, the 50s now, way back, and he lived not far from, he didn't live in Graceland then, he was not that wealthy or famous. But he had made sort of a local success singing and, just some places around Memphis, and enough to buy a small house in the suburbs. and which was not too far from where I lived. And because we had seen him on TV, my girlfriend and I, who we were probably about 13 at the time, decided to ride our bicycles over to his house, which we did more than one time. And the main thing we would do is we somehow found out that, well, first of all, we knew that he had bought his mother a pink Cadillac convertible, which in those days was very unusual car, beautiful car. But he had bought that for his mother, and he lived with his mother and father in this little suburban house. And every day at around 3 or 4 in the afternoon, he would come out the front door with his mother, help her into the pink Cadillac, and wave to all the little groupies, I guess you could call us then. There was no word like that back then, but we were out there waving, and he would wave back. And he was a very gracious, very sweet man, and always kind to people. You know, he wasn't the kind of a star who was mean or anything. He was always, you know, I never thought to ask him for his autograph. I just was waving at him, you know. So that was my only claim to fame. I never really met him personally or anything. And then, of course, very shortly after that, he appeared on Ed Sullivan Show and became the rocket to fame, stardom, of course, that he did. But he was a local boy who made good. He didn't run in my social area. We would have back then called him a hood. What that means is the school I went to was more of a Ivy League thing. You know, you wore the guys wore madras shirts, and you know, there was a certain way you dressed and acted. Elvis went to a school on what we would call the other side of the tracks. He had a long pompadour thing, hairdo with lots of, you know, and he wore black tight pants and pink shirts, and it was an extravagant dresser, even when he was taking his mother for a ride in the Cadillac. So he was quite a character. But he was not, you know, we would have almost kind of made fun of him because he was hoody. I mean, that's the only way I know to put it. But of course, he would have laughed his way all the way to the bank over that one, because he of course achieved incredible stardom and fame. And then, of course, you know, he was very interested in Yogananda. Most people have heard that story. He did visit Mount Washington and Dhyanamata, and I think he tried his best to involve himself more in spiritual things. But I think also he had a terrifically harsh environment around him in the form of what we call them, well, the media calls it that now too, the Memphis Mafia. Meaning many of those men who were around him were people he had grown up with, again, sort of on the other side of the tracks. And they were not too far from, and many possibly were a criminal class. Now, they were just not people you would want to be around. And of course, they influenced him, I think, badly, and got him into the drugs and the things that took his life, really. But I've always felt he was a fine man. And he grew up in Tupelo, Mississippi, which is just a little bit south of Memphis, and came to Memphis, as many people did in those years, to seek his fame and fortune, or whatever it was then. But he had that very interesting karma to be very close to involving himself in spiritual things and just couldn't quite pull it off. But I'm sure we've all had lifetimes like that. So that's that story. So the other story was what?
Your mom.
Oh, my mom. Well, my mom was quite a character. Sudarshan never got to meet my father. He would have loved him because they're a lot alike. But by the time Sudarshan and I met, he was gone, and he died young. I'm an only child, so my mom and I, we had our differences. But later on in her life, she developed Alzheimer's, and we had to go back to Memphis and move her out here to be closer to us. We possibly would have moved her in with us, but there were, again, no end. We had just built a small house and we didn't have much room. But we moved her into a board and care home here, and then went back to Memphis and sold her home. And so it was me being an only child. I would have been taken care of. I did take care of her as best I could for the rest of her life. But one of the things she used to give me advice about men, you know, what kind of men to hang out. And so her one of her favorite things to say to me, and this was before I was married, she said, "Now, sweetie, you can marry anybody you want to. You can marry a rich man, and you can marry a poor man. But if you're wise, you will marry a man who can fix things." Well, she was actually speaking autobiographically, because my father was the type of a person who could fix anything, take a motor apart, put it back together, anything in the world. He was really a mechanical genius in many ways. So I had that as an example, and my father was a wonderful man. But I remember when I first met Sudarshan, I thought, well, he's not rich, that's for sure, and he's not exactly poor, but by golly, he can fix things. So that wasn't the full criteria of why, the full explanation of why Sudarshan and I got married. The main thing I admired about him more than anything was his devotion to God and to Guru. I mean, he was, before anything, he was my fellow disciple and very dedicated. And one of my priorities for a husband at that point would be, I want someone who can meditate better than I can, who meditates longer and better than I do. So I would have that example, or that kind of a partner in life who would inspire me. And certainly he has been that for me. We've been married for, let's see, I guess it's 42 years now. But we met here in 78 and got married in 1980.
Thank you. And congratulations.
Well, yeah, I guess if you're married that long, you're due some congratulations. You better ask him about that.
Okay. Well, I see a pile of books over there, and I suspect that you'd like to share a little bit about them.
Well, yeah, I'm pretty shameless of talking about my books, because that's been sort of my more recent focus. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you a story. It's kind of an interesting story about what Swami had to say to me about writing books. And he has said this to a number of other people here in the community, of course, because both before and after his passing, many people have been writing books now to sort of carry on his tradition of writing spiritually inclusive books that will help people. And the same thing, well, I'll get to that in a minute about why, what he said to me about why I should write books. So my first book, he didn't say anything to me about this. It was called The Chakras Workbook. And I just put this together because I was given a lot of classes about the chakras. And I had noticed that information about the chakras is spread out all over Swami's teachings, all over Master's teachings, but they're not ever in one place, and you have to really thumb through a lot of material. So I thought, well, I'll just make a bunch of charts and handouts and different things that when I'm giving classes on the chakras, that people can have this as a workbook to take home and you know, and work with and understand more about the chakras. So that was just, and I still self-publish this, although Crystal Clarity tells me they want to put it out. It's always been my bestseller. I've written other books here, as you'll see, but for some reason, this little book is I don't know, I can't even remember when I wrote it. I think it was in the 80s, but anyway, it's done well. After I finished that book, I think Swami somehow got wind of it, and he told me, well, why don't you write a real book, this being an unreal book. I knew what he meant. He said, why don't you write a book about the chakras, and we'll put it in our Four Starters series. Back then we had Meditation for Starters and Vegetarian Cooking for Starters and Intuition for Starters. He said, why don't you write a book called Chakras for Starters, and we'll just add that to the collection. So I said, well, I'll give it a try. And I thought to myself, how could I do that? And I thought the very best way I could do that would be to transcribe all of Swami's talks on the chakras, because he had given many. In 1982, at Spiritual Renewal Week, he talked every day, at least two and a half hours. So I had a good 12 hours worth of Swami talking about the chakras that I transcribed. And then I had incredible material, then maybe a few other tapes, recordings of him on that subject. I had way more than I could use. So then my problem was to condense it down, because I had been given a certain number of words and pages that I had to fit it into. So that's how Chakras for Starters, that's my second little book. And it's just Swami. There's very little of me in here, because I used all of his trans. My problem was, and I was literally weeping when I wrote this book, because I had to leave so much stuff out. There were just story after story. You know, it was a beautiful, beautiful series of classes and so much wisdom and so many great stories. And so I had to cut it way down to fit. But I finished it. And shortly after I finished it, he said to me, "Thank you for writing that book. It's a very good book. You did well." And I said, I just couldn't help it. I said, "Well, Swami, it's not really my book. You know, every word in here is from you." And he said, "Oh, don't say that. You put it together. You organized it. You wrote it. It's your book, you know." And he was so kind to me to say that. I was really thrilled that he thought it was at least okay. I did make a companion CT recording to go with it, which Crystal Clarity sells both of these, and they still sell pretty well. This is not a recording of me reading the book. It's a recording of me leading guided meditations on each chakra, and there's music, and there's Swami's on here reading. I couldn't figure out what to do about the seventh chakra. I mean, how do you lead a guided meditation for that? So I just let Swami do it, and he reads Samadhi with the music behind it and everything. So that was fun. So I did that, and I figured, well, that's done. You know, I've done my thing. But I don't know how to explain this, but I've got something going on inside of me that tells me that you need to write another book, and this has gone on for years. So the next thing that I sort of was told to do is that Yogananda has so many wonderful teachings about dreams, why we dream and how we dream and what we dream and what our dreams symbolize. And it's, once again, spread out all of the old lessons, the perceptive lessons and the early lessons and just various things. It had never been kind of put in one place. And I thought, well, maybe I could do that. I don't know how good of a writer I am, but maybe I can consolidate things. And because I think it would be, often in teaching classes, people would bring up the question of what is a dream and what do my dreams mean? And I dreamed about this, what does that mean? You know, so I worked for quite a while researching it, and then I wrote this book called The Meaning of Dreaming. And I deliberately chose that title, not the meaning of what your dream, not the what your dreams mean, but what does it mean to dream? Because that's what Master focused on, Yogananda focused on that topic. When he said the reason you dream, and this is the big point that the book's trying to make, as Yogananda did, is to show you that all of life is a dream. The little nightly dreams we have are just little reflections of the big dream. Now, as we awaken in the morning from our nightly dreams, someday we're going to awaken from this dream of delusion, and we think it is really real, but it in many ways it's not. But Yogananda was thorough in the way he taught about dreams, because he has many lists of, if you dream about a tree, it means this. If you dream about an ocean, it means this. So he does have those dream interpretation lists. But, of course, they couldn't possibly be complete, because all of us dream about all sorts of things. And I created this little way of helping you to interpret your own dreams, because people are always asking me, well, you've written about dreams, interpret my dream. I say, no, it's your dream. It's not what a tree means to me is not the same thing with what a tree means to you if you dream about a tree. So the the best thing to do is make a list of the three or four major items, or the people or things or in your dream, and then ask for guidance. Put it on your altar and say, if this is an important dream and there's something I need to learn, then show me. And that system works actually quite well for most people that have tried it sincerely. And I also say in this book that most of our, as Yogananda said, most of our nightly dreams are they're just subconscious meanderings. They're memories, things, what I did yesterday when I was a kid. We weave them. It says in Yogananda's poem, when my mind weaves dreams, that's in God, God, God. And that is mainly what our mind is doing. Is Yogananda called it entertainment. He said the purpose of life is to instruct and to entertain. And then when he talks about dreams, he said, nightly dreams, he says the purpose of most nightly dreams is to instruct and entertain, but most are just entertainment. Very few are all that instructive. So one thing I tried to approach in this book, as he did, is how do you tell the difference between an important dream, like God is trying to speak to you through your dreams, which God does, or it's just movies, mind movies. So there's a way to differentiate between the two. And interestingly, Swami did talk about, they talked about how it's clearer, it's brighter, the colors are brighter. It's impactful on you. You wake up, you know, this is important. It's not just me dreaming about a horsey and a cowie when I was a kid or something, whatever. This has some kind of meaning. I may not know what it is, but there's some message in here for me that I'd like to know what that is. So I just offer some instructions, as Master did, for the key is always meditation. You know, you say, God, if you have something to show me, I'm open to hear it. Let me take it into meditation and then answer me. What I've found is that often when you ask a question like that or put your list on your altar or whatever, at the end of the meditation, you don't know any more than you did in the beginning. But later on, in a week or the next day, you're walking down the street, whatever it is, all of a sudden you know, oh yeah, I know now. I know what that was. I know what was going on. So it's a fascinating subject. I had a lot of fun writing this. And again, Crystal Clarity publishes it. And all my books, by the way, are all, I think with the exception of the workbook, are on Amazon too. So. Which is doing surprisingly well. I've been kind of surprised at that because I've never gone on a book tour. I've never really promoted my books all that well, but for some reason they seem to have kind of a life of their own. Now, this is a funny story about Swami and me. I think it was about 2008, somewhere along there, I got a call from Swami's secretary. He said, Swami would like to have you over to tea at 4:00 this afternoon. Can you come? Huh. Well, yeah. I mean, I'd never been invited over to tea personally. I mean, she said, is anybody else coming? She said, no, it's just you. What's this about? I had no idea. I thought, well, gosh, she's going to send me to India. Oh, no. What's going to happen? So with my heart in my mouth, I went over to, so of course I was thrilled to be invited to his apartment and have tea. And so it was just him, and his secretary was there, and he was gracious and gave me tea and cookies, and we chatted for a while. And then he said, you know, Savitri, you're a good writer. And I said, well, thank you, Swami. And he said, have you ever thought of writing a novel? And I said, no, well, yes, I had thought about it, but not seriously. Now, you got to remember, at this point, Swami himself had not written a novel. He came to write novels later, but he had written the plays, like The Peace Treaty and things like that, but not specifically a novel. All the works that he wrote up till later on in his life were nonfiction. I mean, they were, you know, The Path, his autobiography, many, many, many wonderful books. But I think he had been thinking about writing one himself, but he just sort of tried out on me. And he says, well, what have you thought about this in the way of a plot? And I thought, well, I guess I'll just go ahead and tell him. I said, well, I've thought that it might be fun, because I've always loved science fiction and things like that. I thought it might be fun to have a character who learns about the yugas by traveling through time, going forward and going backward. The yugas are the great eons of time that Sri Teshwar taught, Master taught, Swami taught. And I thought I could explain karma and reincarnation and the yugas through a fictional character who lives in Treta Yuga, that's many thousands of years ahead of us now, where people just know how to time travel. They go through, they just do that. They know how to do that. He said something like, well, how would you have them time travel? I don't know. I'll figure something out, And he just laughed. He said, oh, okay, well, why don't you write up a chapter outline or something and show it to me? And I said, will you help me with it? And he said, well, I'll pray for you or something like that. I mean, he obviously didn't want to tell me, I'm going to help you sit down and write your novel. You write it and, we'll see. So I said, okay, well, I'll do my best. And I did. It took me 3.5 years to do it. And it's not a very big novel. As you see, it's not very thick. But not being a novel writer, I didn't know what I was doing. Plus, I was working full time and more. So the times I had to write it were minimal, like weekends or sometime in seclusion, or just it was frustrating because I found out when you're writing a novel, your characters need continuity, and I'd have to go back and pick up, and I hadn't thought about them in a month, and I have to go back and find out what they're doing and continue the plot. And I wasn't thrilled with the outcome, but I thought it was okay. So I had some copies printed up, and I went to Swami and I said, here it is. And he didn't say it. I could see the look in his eyes. This is about time. It's been a long time since Swami writes a book in what, 2 weeks or something, a month. He's just. And so he read it. And then he wrote me an email, and he said he didn't like it. And he gave me all the reasons. It's not that he didn't like it. He just felt that it could be better. And he gave me all the reasons, which were very valid and good reasons and so forth. And basically, he was telling me to rewrite it. And I just couldn't. I mean, I just worked so hard, and I felt I'd done my best. And certainly, I was thinking about it, but just about that time, he passed away. And I thought, I'm done. And I did my best. But the other thing that happened before, in between while I was writing it and when he passed away, is he wrote The Time Tunnel. Is that what it's called? The Time Tunnel? Right. He said it was a children's book, but it's really a wonderful book. It's about time travel. And so I often laughingly say I'm directly responsible for that book, because he wasn't pleased at the way I put mine together. So he did it better. He did it, and he did it a lot better. So when he was gone and my book was done and his book was done, I said, well, I'm all done. I did my best. He did better. I'm happy with all of it. It's fine. It was a fun thing to do, and I learned a lot. And if I ever write anything, I certainly will. I mean, I took a lot of notes about what he had said to me about how it could be better and all of that. But I just dropped it, and I said, that's done. That little exercise is over. Well, not too long after he passed away, I was sitting meditating over in the Shrine of the Masters Museum. We used to lead a meditation over there every Saturday morning for 3 hours. For about 18 years, I was always over there on Saturday mornings, and many people were. We had a group meditation. But I was sitting there, and just as clear as anything, I don't know who said, to me it seemed like Divine Mother said, you're not done. You need to write another novel. I just went, oh no, oh no, are you sure about it? Oh no. I mean, how can I do this? So, of course, I prayed about it and meditated about it, but I said, okay, I'm making some conditions here. First of all, I'm not going to try to work and write at the same time. So I'm going to, if I need to write another novel, I'm going to take a sabbatical, a whole year off, and do it, and nothing else, because I figured it'd take me that long to do it. Turns out it didn't. But the other thing is that I'm going to choose a topic that I enjoy and I already know a lot about. So I chose the chakras. Okay. Third thing is I'm going to take the characters in here because I liked them. I've gotten to know them. And they were young people in this first book. I'm going to let them grow up a little bit into middle age. And they can be the characters in the second novel. So I don't have to reinvent the characters. They're just a little older and wiser. So then the plot started coming to me. And so I really did. I took a whole year off and worked on this book. But mainly in May of that year, that was 2015, I moved down to the Yuba River. I left home here and moved into a cabin, a little tent on the river, a little cabin there. And I didn't work. I didn't see anybody. I mean, Sudarshan came down and resupplied me with food, and I had friends come down sometime. But I didn't really, I just immersed myself in, through the chakras, I call it, adventures in the, a tale of adventures in the seven golden pyramids. So I had the characters going through these pyramids that represented each chakra, and it was so much fun. And the thing was, at this time, the characters really came alive to me. In the first one, I was kind of manipulating them. In the second one, they told me what to do. This is what we're going to do now, and this is what we're going to do now. It was so much fun. It was like taking dictation. And so I was thrilled with it. I still think it's the best book, well, certainly the most fun that I ever did. So I finished it. I published it. I was very happy with it. Done. Swami said, write a novel. Didn't like this one too much. Not around for me to ask about this one, but I think he would have been pleased. And I felt the way I put it, and he often put it about Yogananda, I felt his smile in my heart. So done, you know, done. Well, you know what? I wasn't done because the characters wouldn't let me go. They weren't complete. I was, oh, please. I mean, this, writing a novel, I'm here to tell you, at least for me, is not easy. It's just not easy. The nonfictions, they sort of put themselves together. You research it and so forth, and the material's there. So I just finally just sort of gave in. I said, okay, what do you want? This time it's the characters talking to me more than Divine Mother, as best I could tell. And they said, complete the journey. What does that mean? Well, okay, I'll kill you. How's that? I'll bring you to the end of your life, and you can die and go into the astral world, and we'll discuss that. How about that? Because I had, you know, what I had is what we on our path have. To me, which is the most thrilling chapter in the autobiography of a yogi, is the resurrection of Sri Yukteswar, where you go into the astral worlds and the causal worlds and you find out what death is and what's after death. And I thought, well, now I could probably weave a pretty good story around that one. Yeah, I think maybe I could do that because I could use that chapter as my basis and so forth. And so I asked the main characters, I said, do you want to die? And they said, sure. Okay, so this is called Through the Gates of Death and Beyond, Adventures in the Locus of Immortality, because I wanted to stress that we really don't die. And you know what, when I was researching titles on Amazon for, you know, just to get some ideas of what I wanted to name this book, there was a famous author on there that somehow I ran across her site. She said, never put the word death in the title of a book unless you're writing a murder mystery. But that's the name of my book, Through the Gates of Death. I thought about it for a while. I thought, well, maybe I better change it. Maybe books won't sell if you have a, I thought, oh, come on. That's immature. If somebody can't handle the word death in the title of my book, they don't deserve to read it anyway. You know. So anyway, I kept my original title, which is Through the Gates of Death and Beyond. Of course, the and beyond is the most important part. And in the subtitle, the word immortality, because Nobody dies. And so I was back working again. So again, this one I had, it took me longer than the one I did. That I thought was going to take a whole year basically took me about 4 months because I had the time. This, I again had to write it, and you know, I was working half time, so there was a little more time. But the other thing about this one is I felt it very important to research it more, because I wanted to be sure I knew what Master said about death, about Yogananda's entry, Teshwar, and all our masters have said about what it's like to die, what the process is, and they have so much to say. It's amazing. Not just in the autobiography of Yoga, but other places where what happens 1 second after you die? What happens 2 seconds after you die? What is a life review? Is that such a thing? And the answer is yes. And then how do you go from this body into wherever you go? Well, you go through the tunnels of the spiritual eye. Anyway, they describe it in such incredible detail, and I think most people don't really know that. Or else they're afraid to investigate it, because most people are afraid. It's not so much they're afraid of death, they're just uncertain. You know, who really knows what happens? And of course, if you have an upbringing like I did in my church, you know, you better be darn good or you'll die and go to hell forever, eternity, and, you know, in the fiery pits, you know, there's that part of it. Of course, I wanted to explain why that's not true. And so I did have a marvelous time writing this book. And when I finished it, I knew I was done. I mean, now I have a trilogy of three books that take place in our future in Treta Yuga. And I like them. I like to read. I've read them many times. I like them. I really enjoy reading my own books. So the only other book I ever wrote, I just thought I'd show you this. I don't really sell it openly too much. It's called Through My Eyes. It's a book of poetry and little essays that I've written over the years since I was following through this and through that. So I wrote this basically just to give away as Christmas presents and things like that. But that, people ask me, are you going to write more? I say, is this not enough? Well, I don't think so. I think I have completed that part of my life. I spend a lot of time writing, a lot of emails, people write me, and I ask for advice and various things. People who read my books write me and ask specific questions, maybe, you know, especially the one about death. It's intriguing and frightening to people, and so I feel like if I can bring some comfort. One close friend I have who lost her husband said she read my Through the Gates of Death 8 times in the months after her husband's passing, because it just gave her such comfort. Just to hear one person say something like that when you've labored hard over writing as I have, it makes it worth it. It makes it worth it. But life goes on, and we move into different phases of our life, and I'm in a different phase of my life now. I'm happy with what I've done, but no, I don't feel any major impulse at all right now to do any more than maybe write small articles or answer emails or that sort of thing. I enjoy the writing process very much. It's just something, I don't know, maybe I was born with it or something. It's really fun for me. It's not, well, it is effort, especially when you're trying to put together a cohesive book that people would enjoy. It takes a lot of effort. And as you know, Dambara, my person that's interviewing me right now, he helped me to edit and proof. There's a lot of editing that has to go on and proofing and to try to get the errors out of it. And it's amazing how often you have disconnects in your book and you don't realize you've done it. You have somebody saying something and then it doesn't connect with something that goes on a little later in the book. And if you have other people's eyes on it, and thank God for people like you, Dambara, who have been willing to help me go through that process of getting a book not just written but ready for publication. and get all the errors out of it. Oh my goodness, the grammar, the spelling. It's really something. But Swami, I have to say, was certainly my inspiration. He was such an amazing writer. His books are really beyond belief. His novels are incredible. And then he didn't write that many. I don't know, three, four of those. But all the rest of his books are timeless. I mean, they'll be read forever or for a long, long time into our future. I'm certain of that. So anyway, you asked a question. You got a probably much longer answer than you wanted.
That's perfect.
And forgive me if I seem shameless in plugging my books, but it has been a major part of my life lately and a wonderful part of it. And I'm so grateful to Swami Kriyananda for encouraging me to do that, because I wouldn't have. I simply would have not thought that I could do it. You know how it is when you just, somebody says something, if somebody ever comes to you and says, "I think you should write a book," well, it's like, what? Unless you're, already doing it or something like that. It's just like, I don't know if I could do something like that. It sounds hard. And it is true. The truth is, it's not easy. But when you ask for help and you ask for guidance and you meditate and you pray, like anything else in this world, you get help. You do get help. Unless God decides it's hard or whatever, it's not a good thing for you to be doing, but that's help too. That's if I'd gotten the word anywhere along the way saying, "Don't, you're not doing the right thing," well, I would have not done it. So I hope that it's been helpful for me in my own spiritual life, but I certainly hope also that it has helped others at least somewhat. Yeah, so that's that story.
So you are, you enjoy sharing and teaching and helping others. So being in this fourth ashram stage, what can you share that would help others about that?
It's been a real period of adjustment for me to try to understand what it means to be in the fourth ashram. Does that mean you just hole up somewhere and don't talk to people and meditate all the time? It doesn't seem to be that's going to be my way. I can't say what it would be for anyone. I think people are going to have to discover this on their own. I did have some health challenges which nudged me in the direction of being less public. And so right now I'm really not teaching any classes publicly or giving Sunday services or anything. I've sort of pulled back from that. That was, that, knowing me, I probably would not have done that. But it's as though Divine Mother has her plans, for my life, and I had to listen. And so I think really honestly it's going to be a very individual thing for everyone. The guidelines are given are what the ashrams or the stages of life, that's traditional teachings from India. You have your school days, your childhood, your school days, and you have your middle years where you're a householder or whatever you do, your active years I should say, and then you have the third ashram is kind of a transition between the second and the fourth, as I understand it, where you are withdrawing but not fully withdrawn. But you're more of a teacher, you're teaching the next generation that comes along. And certainly, I've had a lot of experience in teaching teachers. So, in a way, I felt like I had fulfilled the third ashram. But the fourth ashram, it's going to obviously take me to when I too go through the gates of death and beyond. And so it's a learning process, really. Because I don't, frankly, I just don't see any really sharp role models around me at Ananda Village. People don't tend to retire. They die with their boots on. They go for it to the end. And that is probably a very good thing to do. It depends on how your life unfolds for you. I think that's probably what I would have done except that just wasn't in the cards for me. It just, I had to make some changes in my life. I had no choice. And but it's good for me. It's part of my karma and my life. So I've just learned, as we all must, to accept things as they come, to make the best of them. But the idea of giving up serving others, I'm not sure I could do that. It could be that there'll come a time when it's just simply not possible. I don't know. But until that time comes, I feel that we as Ananda Sanghis, it's just our life. I mean, most of us find that we are compelled to try to help others with their spiritual path. Or certainly as you grow older, you have all this experience. And why not share it if you can in some way, shape, or form? So I don't have the answers. Maybe I'll write another book before I leave to say, okay, this is what the fourth ashram is. But I don't think that would be possible. I think it's going to have to be a bit different for everybody as they find their way. That's the best I can do with that one.
Yeah. I'm smiling because I recall it was Gyandev, I believe, who speculated that maybe your final book would be called Through with Savitri.
Yeah. I said, Gyandev, thanks a lot. You know, I got through many lives and through the chakras and through the gates of death, and now we have Through with Savitri. I laughed a lot. It was funny. But, yeah. that's the final ashram there.
There it is.
Done with this lifetime.
All right, that feels like a great endpoint.
Okay.
Thanks, dear one.
God bless.